Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. There is an incredible facility right here in downtown Toronto that is helping on the front lines and is doing incredible innovative research. They are a facility that treats everybody with dignity, and they need your help. May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. If this matters to you, help CAMH. There's no better place for your resources. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand and donate now. Help CAMH treat addiction and build hope.
The way that Canadian media play out, it's an endless hockey game between the Canadian Habs and the Maple Leafs, and people of color in Quebec are basically we are the puck. We're not even players. We are the puck, and it's just two different kind of white people, you know, trying to argue which kind of white people is the best. And personally, I'm not interested in that debate.
But which kind of white person is the best? We'll save that debate for a later episode. Today, I have to reckon with the painful accuracy of the analogy that you just heard. But I can't pretend that it's news to me. I know that conversations about racism held between two white guys can be painful. Perhaps as painful as this podcast's coverage to date of Quebec media. Let's reach into the mailbag. Hi, Jesse. I noticed you don't talk much about what's going on in the Quebec media landscape on the show. Hi, Jesse. I do think that a great way forward for Canada Land would be to have more Quebec coverage or awareness. Dear Jesse, as a Quebecer, I noticed a lack of Quebec coverage, even when Quebec was an integral part of the story. You shouldn't call it Canada Land until you can include all parts of Canada in it, and stop treating Quebecers as if they're some sort of scary object. I think you were better than that. There's more. Jesse, I think your show could benefit from speaking to journalists who are either currently working in Quebec or have lived in Quebec and who can speak and read French. Hi, Canada Land. It makes me sad that even Canada Land can't do the coverage of Quebec affairs properly. Which begs the question, why can't Anglos get Quebec coverage right? You know, the problem with blind spots is that they're in your blind spot. But I want to do better. And not in a kind of a hangdog, I'll try to be better kind of a way. But in the sense that if we can do better, if we can crack the two solitudes, there's good shit there. The Quebec media scene is vibrant and feverish and lurid. This show would be so much better if we could do that well and if we could do that now. I mean, how is Me Too playing out in Quebec? Over the summer, this list was going around of Quebec men accused of misconduct. It was a long list, filled with names of famous people who I have never heard of. And how is Black Lives Matter playing out, with people who are known for taking to the streets in protest, even without a global movement motivating them to do so? How is anti-racism playing out in a province where a xenophobic anti-immigrant media figure, like newspaper columnist Richard Martineau, wields more power and influence than any columnist in English Canada? I'd like to know. And with tons of gratitude to the dudes who have talked to me about Quebec in the past, to Patrick Legasse and Martin Patrick Quinn and Les Perrault, I think we can do better. Today, I'm going to talk to the woman whose voice you heard at the beginning of today's episode. Columnist, journalist, and anthropologist, Emily Nicolas. Emily writes for Le Devoir and will be teaching a class on Black Lives Matter and the media at the University of Toronto this winter. Wait for it. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Kiefer Waite, Melinda Brickwood, Carrie Cullen, Jyoti Solanki-Davy, Scott Benham, Carlisle, Jocelyn Wainwright, and Hayden Jones.
Hi, my name is Hayden Jones, and I'm a software developer in Toronto, Canada. I support Canada Land because they produce good journalism in a format I like, podcasts. And I don't want to say that I like Jesse Brown, but I don't not like him.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp, therapy online that has served over 3 million people around the world, and it's available here in Canada. And this time of year, we're all emerging from our winter, like, seclusion and, you know, patio season and socializing, and it can be terrifically fun, but it can also create a lot of pressure. And some people get, like, anxiety, social anxiety from being out too much. What did Iggy Pop say about social life? It's torture dressed as fun. It doesn't need to be torture. I think it's just about finding, like, the right balance of how much of other people do you want? I mean, we need each other, but I think that at a certain point, it can become overwhelming. And talking to somebody about yourself, about your social life, about your relationships is a way of gaining insight into what is right for you. It's not selfish to examine that with a professional. And as the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Listeners of the show get 10% off of their first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's better, H-E-L-P, betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. We got a tour of their facilities in their downtown Toronto campus, and I was blown away by the heroic work that these people are doing. They are saving lives every day. I know people whose lives were saved, and they just really care about the dignity of the people who turn to them for help. Look, we talk a lot about these issues on Canada Land. We talk about the crisis that is claiming 20 lives every day in Canada to drug overdoses, but we don't give you a lot of options of what you can do about it. CAMH is an option. CAMH desperately needs resources that they directly put into their work, saving lives and turning people's lives around. Listen, May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. This is when they need your help the most. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. Hi, Emily.
Hi.
I have been trying to comprehend the impact of, like, the convergence of Me Too and Black Lives Matter and what's happening with the critique of policing and the protests against policing and what's happening as a result in the media and all of that stuff as it applies to Quebec. And my mind boggles, and I'm really curious to understand it. My problem is, I have been trying to understand it through conversations with white Anglo men. So I'm really glad to be speaking with you right now.
Yeah, you're far off. I mean, some white Anglo men get it because they get their information locally, but it's hard to have an understanding of what's been going on, especially if it's only focusing with what's been happening in English speaking media. There's always a bubble, I find, that is hard to translate sometimes myself, even as someone who kind of works on both sides. There's a very different news cycle on in both in French and English in this country. It's almost like we have two country in one. So yeah, it makes it hard to follow sometimes.
So yeah, an old story of two solitudes, except these are global movements.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And it's happening the same thing, you know, when you're talking about Black Lives Matter, for example, in France or in Latin America as well, it kind of follows its own beat. And sometimes I feel as North American, we don't necessarily realize that the ways of US is not necessarily the ways of the world. And there are distinct conversations going on.
If you were like, I mean, we don't hang out at airport bars anymore, but if you were at an airport bar speaking to an American, just trying to introduce them to the idea, like, this is happening in Quebec, but it's happening very differently, how would you describe that?
in the late 80s, Anthony Griffith was killed in Montreal. He was a black man killed by the Montreal police. And in many ways, that was the start of police brutality protests in Montreal on the kind of scale and impact that we've seen elsewhere in North America. Mercedes Francois as well, who was killed in 91. So there's a whole generation who's been doing that way before, you know, the in its own way, independently from the U.S., before the Black Lives Matter hashtag, just like they were protests as well elsewhere in Canada and the U.S. as well, before the Black Lives Matter movement per se. In 28, Freddy Villanueva, who is a young immigrant from Honduras, he was 18 years old, was killed by the police in Montreal North, which is a borough of Montreal that is... has been marginalized for a very long time. This is where you have also a very large part of the black population in the city. And when Freddy was killed, this is very much when, you know, Freddy became a symbol in the city. And a lot of the protests around police brutality very much rallied around Freddy. You had also riots that happened then. It's kind of our, you know, 91 LA kind of movement. This is what happened with Freddy Villanueva in Montreal North. And once again, this movement is not called Black Lives Matter, right? And so you have those conversations going on, and they're very happening at their kind of own pace with the beats of what's happening locally. And some of that is framed in a way that's similar to what you have elsewhere in North America. But some of it is also, you know, the way that people organize is distinct. Because, for example, Freddy Villanueva, although most of the organizers around with people who rallied around this figure were black, but Freddy himself, he's Latino and he's not black, right? So it's also a movement in Quebec that's definitely focused on anti-black racism, but also includes you know, people who are not black, but are also racialized and victims of police brutality. So, yeah, the movement is just has a slightly different beat and color. And so, with the latest killings that have been happening, people have been, of course, trying to join those movements. But it's important when we do that, also not to, I guess, erase the local history of it, because when you do that, you also erase a local, I guess, wisdom of how to make those issues visible in the local media. Quebec has its own, you know, mindset, its own history. And if you just apply, I guess, things the way they're being said in the US, you just repeat them in French, it doesn't necessarily work that well. And so it's very important as well to kind of adapt your message.
When I think about Quebec, I definitely think about a culture where protest on the streets is a big part of the culture, and the protests, maybe this is unfair, but I think of them as the propensity for them to become physical seems higher in youth protests I associate with Quebec. But I also think of racism specifically in Quebec differently than I do in other parts of Canada. Is Quebec more racist than the rest of Canada, or is it just a different flavor?
Well, there's a lot of things in what you just said. In terms of the protests, I don't know if there's more violent, but there's just more protests in general, right? And we've seen, for example, the student movement in 2012. It's something that it's I don't know more, it's Black Lives Matter, but it's also actually white young people who also protest a lot. So that's the first part. The second part, is Quebec more racist? I think it's very hard to define racism just like that. So it very much depends on what you're talking about. But one thing for sure is that every nation, every culture has racism. And then that's kind of universal. And then when you look at each context, it just plays out a little bit differently. There's like a little local flavor, a little twist on it. In Canadian racism in general, both in Ontario and Quebec, there's a lot of denial of it being a local reality. And that's something that both Toronto and Montreal share, you know, always having to explain that systemic racism is not just an American thing. That's something that all Canadians who have grown up with a certain narrative of what Canada is struggle to understand, that the fact that, you know, the narrative of Canada being this kind of la-la land is very far from the truth, both when it comes to anti-Black racism and Indigenous rights. There's been a lot of a very dark history on those two aspects since the very founding of this country. And here, for example, in Quebec, there's a very stark erasure of the history of slavery, which took place, you know, know, in New France since the very beginning of the colony. And most people are not taught about that in school at all. And so most people end up not knowing that slavery is actually not only a Canadian thing, but a French-Canadian thing as well. And so because there's this absence of knowledge, it's very hard to have those conversations. But moreover, I'd say what makes it very difficult is that people are very comfortable actually talking about racism when it comes to racism against French Canadian, right? And so there is a history of discrimination and there is a history of inequalities between French and English white settlers in this country. And because there is a truth to that, French settlers happen to just talk about that aspect of their history, but also fail to kind of see how this history of, you know, catching up in the 60s and the 70s, where French Canadians had their kind of economic boom and started to reduce this gap. Well, that catching up happened at the expense of Indigenous people in Northern Quebec, for sure, who, you know, were on the receiving end of the dams and the Hydro-Québec and all the things that are, you know, the flagship of the Quiet Revolution movement. But it also happened at the expense of newer immigrant population who were not giving the same opportunities of as French Canadians. And so it's kind of this country having so many different layers of injustice and colonization. And everybody, I think it's a general human tendency to want to focus in your personal narrative on the things that makes you look good or makes you look like, you know, the hero of the story, and doesn't make you don't want to insist as much on the aspects of it that makes you the bad guy, right? And so I think in French Canadian culture, people insist on the parts where they were wronged historically, but there's very little awareness still of how actually, although you might have been discriminated against in some ways, you are also white and you are also dominant in North America in other ways as well. And so as a Black woman in Quebec, it's you're always trying to fight this kind of narratives. And so unless I'd say, for example, in a city like Toronto, you have to argue with white people that they're actually white and that they're actually dominant. That is not something that you can take as a given. And that's something that anti-racist movements have to, you know, take a lot of airtime to actually, you know, help unpack the history of French Canada and trying to see, yes, you live this and this and that, but also anti-Black racism is a local reality and you live on stolen land. And those two things can be true at the same time. And that's a hard thing for a lot of people to wrap their head around, for sure.
Yeah, especially people who consider themselves oppressed. I mean, there's a history, I guess, of claiming a certain fealty or similarity. And, you know, the book by Pierre Valliere that got Wendy Mesley in so much trouble for citing, and just so people comprehend, I'll say the book title is White N-Words of America, where the French-Canadian cause was, the Quebecois cause was equated with the Black American cause. But there's a certain entitlement in thinking that that's not seeing the distinctions, and maybe that lives to this day when you've got a society where those who, I guess, define themselves by freeing themselves from the oppression from the church or oppression from English Canada are themselves a dominant people in a culture where so many other people live.
Yeah. You know, Pierre Valliere's book, it's hard to translate, right? Nègre blanc d'Amérique, because nègre can mean more Negroes and nigger. It depends on the context. But basically, Pierre Valliere himself was this guy that had a very, very critical view, basically, of British imperialist capitalism, the way that it played out in Montreal. And sometimes we forget in Toronto, but actually Montreal was a metropolis of the Canadian economy until the 70s. And so what was happening in the popular neighborhoods of Montreal was very much representative of industrialization in Canada in general in that period. And while he was kind of trying to make weird metaphors and association with African Americans, it's interesting also how in his later essays, he kind of recognized that some of that was a mistake. And there's very interesting quotes of him saying that if Quebecois nationalism continues on the path that it's on, or if people are not careful, it can metamorph into something that's more about, you know, xenophobia and ethnic nationalism. It's really interesting how now you have people who are basically ethnic nationalists in many ways, who are now trying to defend the right to quote Pierre Valliere, while Pierre Valliere himself would have probably said, because he was a leftist revolutionary in some ways, although that title was definitely a mistake. And so he would probably be against those guys today, the kind of conservative nationalists that we have that has become so mainstream.
The final piece of this that we haven't got to yet is sexism. And I mean, I think about a generation who, for them, you know, feminism and issues of sex and gender, I think had a lot to do with casting them their freedom from the church and expressing themselves sexually.
Yes.
And now it's a younger generation has some sort of finer points about equality and abuse. And seems to be, from my perspective over here, just an absolute defiance, a reactionary refusal to hear this. And I don't think that people who consume English language media in Canada fully appreciate the cultural role of Richard Martineau and other columnists in Quebec. I wonder if you can talk a little bit just about how your messages are received, how that conversation is playing out, and those kinds of disparities in power and clout in the media sphere.
Well, I'm just going to go back into history for a bit, because I think that's the piece that's missing. When people are not understanding what's going on in Quebec, I think it's because there's a gap in terms of the social history of the place. And so when you're seeing only the things at the surface and not what's behind it, it's hard to figure it out. But yes, a lot of the social movements basically in that generation was very much against a very conservative version of the Catholic Church that had been able to take hold in Quebec. And it's also important to understand that the church was only so strong because of the context of British imperialism, where you don't necessarily have the state to protect your culture. Then the church kind of came in as being the unofficial state representative of French Canadians in some ways, especially during the late 19th century, in the beginning of the 20th century. With industrialization, people were leaving rural Quebec, where basically being a very homogeneous village, you know, trapped to French and religion was not really a thing, but moving to cities or moving to New England in the US, the church started to crack down basically and trying to be a lot more conservative. And for example, the generation of my grandmother, because I'm mixed, right? My father's from Haiti and my mother's French Canadian. That generation, it was not uncommon to have families of 10, 14 children, because women were told that it was against the will of God to stop having children, even though you could risk dying in child labor, things like that. And so when you understand the feminist movement in Quebec as very much taking a stand against what the Catholic Church was doing at the time, you also understand a little bit better some of the arguments that are being thrown around in terms of secularism and Islamophobia and all of that. You basically have French Canadian historical experience of religion being something that means every woman on earth is supposed to have the same religion, the same relationship with religion, basically. So this is how you have people who in the 60s and the 70s actually were identifying on the left, were identifying as feminists. And then, you know, fast forward a couple of decades, you have people who don't come from the same kind of background, or people my generation who don't remember that kind of Catholic Church, who are just, you know, wanting women to be able to wear whatever they want to wear and not have either the state or the church actually tell them what to do. And there's this absolute disconnect between people who cannot fathom that it's possible for other women to have a different relationship to religion than the one they had and the one they remember their mothers having, for example. And so secularism, the conversation around secularism and their history of Quebec are absolutely interrelated. That is not a way to excuse the kind of rhetoric that's been out there since the beginning of the 2000. But also, if we want to fight the Bill 21, for example, we really need to understand where some of that is coming from because you cannot fight in what you don't understand is something that I strongly believe.
And thinking of Bill 21, you know, this ban on against religious head coverings for government workers and against the niqab, against the burqa, and then, you know, the hypocrisy of it when we enter the pandemic. I don't know. how you know bans on face coverings work right now.
Yes, no, they don't work for sure.
So it's like a dogmatic secularism. It's like secularism taken to an extreme, like an extreme ideology of anti-religiosity.
Yes, and that's a very French thing as well. You know, because when we talk about the Quiet Revolution, it's in contrast with the very violent revolution that was the French Revolution that basically beheaded the church, all the bishops and whatnot in France. And so, and in France, there is a strong intellectual tradition of people who are not only atheists, but believe basically that because they are atheists, they are superior, and that people who believe in religions are backward, are people who are still in the Middle Ages, people who live in the dark, and that, you know, being an atheist is having shed the kind of barbarian belief, or, you know, I'm obviously paraphrasing, that people used to have in backward cultures, basically. And so that's a very strong intellectual French tradition. And there's a lot of Quebecois intellectual who either study in France or are in connection with that movement. And so you do have a laïcité movement in Quebec that is not only for, you know, separation of church and state, which is a goal that everybody, of course, I think wants the state to be able to do and make decisions that independently from the influence of the church. That's a very good thing. But there's also the other kind of laïcité, which is very much about atheism as the state religion and every other religion not being equal, but actually being inferior. And there's a confusion in between those things. And that's definitely also shaping up the debate. And all of that being misunderstood is right now weaponized as something that is against basically the rights of Muslim women. And that's very wrong. But once again, if we want to fight that, we need to understand what people are actually saying.
It's a culture that, like, seems to be so defined by defiance to what the English-speaking world wants of it. But now we have this conflict where the defiance is taking on, we will defiantly cling to blackface because it means something different here and you can't tell us how to laugh and what's funny and you don't know our traditions. Or a defiance, artistic defiance of Robert Lepage saying, no, I have a right to do this slave play. And I won't be told what I can and can't express as an artist. And I think just to have English Canada or America asserting what is appropriate or inappropriate in French Canada is just going to be defied, even when it comes at the expense of and harms people within Quebec.
Right. I would not. I mean, when you say it's a culture defined by defiance, I would not agree with that in the sense that, I don't know, it's just the anthropologist side of me. It's like, you cannot define cultures with a word like that. And I don't think that's fair. Although I do understand what you mean in the sense that because the pressure of assimilations on French Canadians were so strong, there is this kind of now knee-jerk reflect whenever something is said in English to kind of be like, no, we're not English, so we're not for that concept. And so that makes sometimes conversations for more difficult. For example, myself and others in 2016, we started a campaign to have the Quebec government acknowledge that systemic racism is a thing and inquire into the ways in which it plays out in the police, in the education system, and healthcare, and all the things that the provincial government is responsible for. And a lot of the backlash that we've had for that campaign is people saying, well, systemic racism is an English concept, so it doesn't apply to Quebec. So whenever people feel like something is said in English, it automatically, you will have some part of the population, right? Not everybody, obviously, but some part of the population who use it as a way to counter that concept. Just like the Black Lives Matter movement, because it's a movement that started in the US, people will try to say it's a US problem, it's not our problem. And in a way, that's not necessarily very different than what other Canadians are doing, right? When there's an American problem saying, no, Canada is distinct, so what's going on in the US is not necessarily our issue. So yes, there is this kind of like differentiation tactics that are playing out. But so it makes it more complicated. And I'd say that when you are here as a woman of color or as a people who are trying to build, you know, more inclusive societies or trying to fight racism here, you're always fighting two fronts. You're fighting the misunderstanding and trying to build larger awareness in the general public in Quebec. But also whenever people especially in Trudeau media, are trying to be, you know, what the hell, why is Quebec so racist? It actually makes my job more difficult.
How so?
Because it triggers those knee-jerk reflex. And then people become defensive. And then people, you know, want to reply to those Torontonians or whatever. And it becomes a fight basically about Quebec and English. And it does not become a fight about our human rights. And it's so complicated sometimes. It feels like... the way that Canadian media play out, it's an endless hockey game between the Canadian Habs and the Maple Leafs. And people of color in Quebec are basically we are the puck. We're not even players. We are the puck. And it's just two different kind of white people, you know, trying to argue which kind of white people is the best. And personally, I'm not interested in that debate. And so that's sometimes why I'm kind of not necessarily, you know, I'm being careful in the way that you're asking some of your questions, because I know how unhelpful that debate is. And I'm personally not interested in having conversations as we were having back in the plantation of like, who is the best master? No, I'm trying to be free, you know? So I'm not interested in trying to see which kind of dominant society is the most flawless, because I'm also very cognizant of how sometimes people want to know more about the problems that are happening in Quebec in a way to, you know, divert the attention or not pay attention to what's going on locally in Ontario. And I don't want to be, you know, that pawn that's going to talk about exotic racism in Quebec for you to, you know, better be able to ignore what's going on in Toronto or what's going on in the prairies. I know this country too well, and I know how this plays out as well.
Oh my God, that's so good. That's so devastating and true and so implicating of me. it's so comfortable. Like it just all clicked. Everything you said is so true. It's so comfortable that the position for me to point a finger and then to kind of click into established roles. Fuck you, Jesse. You're not going to tell me from Toronto that you're more racist. And then it just the conversation is just it's just taken completely away from the people who it matters to most. You're the puck. Oh my God. I'm aware that trends like, you know, the Me Too movement brought to media circles in New York a list that was circulating called the Shitty Media Men List, where women were sharing the names of men to avoid and men who were accused of being predators and sexual misconduct in various ways. And
right.
there is more recently a Quebec version, excuse my pronunciation, Dis Son Nom List, similar list. I had a look at it. It's a long list, and I can't say I was shocked by that. I didn't recognize a lot of the names, and it was one of those frequent reminders of just how there is just a complete, distinct, and robust ecosystem of celebrities, musicians, media personalities that I'm blind to. How did this kind of episode within the media sphere in Quebec play out from your perspective?
Like many other things in Quebec, it plays out at the intersection of what's going on in North America and what's going on in France. In France as well, it's not necessarily called the Me Too movement, but you've had a very strong movement in the last years of people denouncing celebrities. And there's a lot of scandals that have been happening there. And also, even before the Me Too movement, sometimes we don't remember, but the whole giant gumishy thing and the being raped, not reported hashtag that was there before Me Too. And that started conversation in Toronto, but that hashtag was also translated agression non dénoncée, and that also sparked a conversation on social media. Then Me Too happened, mm-hmm. started a whole bunch of conversation. Gilbert Rozon, for example, who's the founder of Juste pour rire, Just for Laughs Festival, fell in that movement, and it prompted a very big conversation in the comedian scene in Quebec, which is a lot bigger than people can imagine. And then this summer, as people were focusing on Black Lives Matter in June, then in July, what you had is another wave, basically a second wave of Me Too, where people on Instagram accounts, anonymous Instagram pages, started to post anonymous testimonials of women speaking against some men. Some of that, it started with tattoo artists and, you know, people who are not necessarily famous, and then it became about big household names. And once again, you have the media industry who's trying to I guess, react to this and trying to figure out ways to represent wokeness or to, you know, show virtue, speaking, say, you know, basically you have agencies saying they will not be associated with artists anymore, which I don't know which problem it solves, but it clears the name of the agency in some ways. And you have shows being pulled out of the air because they are involving people who have been accused. And so it's been a kind of a shitstorm, actually, since the summer. And it's very much focused on the star system here, which is very unique bubble because of French television. People being only speaking French makes a captive audience for French TV channels, actually, which makes Quebec television actually have a lot more higher ratings than Canadian televisions, because English Canadians can listen to American TV a lot too easy, I guess, for Canadian productions to take off the way they do in Quebec, relatively speaking.
By an order of magnitude, the role that Canadian English television plays in the cultural life of English speaking Canadians is like, it's a little footnote afterthought to our American consumption.
Yes. But
the boomers have to go away eventually. I note that within the Quebec media, there's a young generation that is, you know, willing to like leave their good jobs at Journal de Montréal, because they're tired of having to explain at parties that they work for the same paper that that publishes Martineau. And this malaise, as your colleagues at other newspapers have described it, it can't last forever. What comes next in Quebec? Or am I wrong? Are they going to cling on forever? Those who will not hear this and will not change, and maybe have reason to. They have created a society that's distinct and that serves them and that privileges them. Maybe they've got something to protect, but can they hold on to it forever? What happens next?
Well, yeah, of course. When you're trying to describe the Quebec media environment like that, we're always going to make generalizations. So the reality is more nuanced than that. But it's really important to understand that yes, you have a. It's a small market, basically, and Québécois, which actually used to own Sun Media for a while, is a very big chunk of the market, and that plays a role. And Québécois is owned by the former leader of the Parti Québécois, Pierre-Carl Péladeau, and so there's a very strong ideological band there, just like there is in some ways as well in La Presse and in Le Devoir. All of the newspaper has their own ideological kind of band. But it's hard for people who don't identify with, any of those answers to find a home and to have a voice. And regardless of where the movements or the media, one thing that Radio-Canada included, one thing that all of them have in common is that they are absolutely not representative of the Quebec population and definitely not the Montreal population, right? You have the most popular radio show, radio station in Montreal, 98.5. I don't know that they have actually any person of color as a mm-hmm. host, or it's behind 1% of the, but, and while Montreal is 1/3 racialized, right? And so basically people are not visible at all. And what happens is you have sometimes a new generation of journalists who are just like exactly like actually in the rest of the country, they try to come in as interns and whatnot. And then they see that the newsroom culture is not necessarily, friendly, let's put it this way. There are some frustrations or misunderstandings. And so people leave, people are trying to start their own media, but there's definitely a sense of, having a generation that doesn't feel themselves represented, not only in media, but also, television and the arts and cultures in the movies. And while that's a problem everywhere, I'd say specifically what it means in Quebec is if, for example, you have more diversity in English media and people my generation are more bilingual, what it means is that you have a generation that will actually listen to English TV Although they're, you know, the children of Bill 101, and you've tried to do everything you can to make that generation francophone, people will identify more with the material that's out there provided to them in English. And so even if you want Quebec to go on as a French speaking society, if you cannot create content that actually looks like your population, you might end up losing a generation that will never sacrifice, you know, having, I will be Black, you know, regardless, no matter what. And if there's no space for me to see myself in Black, as Black in Quebec, or in French, then people like myself are more likely to actually go consume content somewhere else. And that's definitely a problem if you understand also the broader, you know, disequilibrium that exists in this continent in terms of language and culture, for sure.
And to make content for other places, I mean, with the declining birth rate after Catholicism, the idea was that it was going to be French-speaking Haitians and Lebanese. The regeneration was supposed to come of the culture from people like you, but that would only be possible if room could be made and if it could have evolved to include.
Yes, and then you realize what are the Francophone-speaking country? There's Haiti, but also there's Senegal and, you know, Algeria and Tunisia, mm-hmm. and Morocco. All of these places are Muslim. And then if you don't want to have, you know, if you have, there's some sort of Islamophobia that's being peddled by some pundits since the basically 9/11, then you end up creating this wedge between people who were brought to Quebec because they're Francophone. And then you tell them that they can never be Quebecois because of some other aspect of their identity.
Is there a burgeoning independent media scene? Are people of color within French-speaking Canada making media and news for each other? I see these French podcasts popping up and beating English language podcasts on the charts all the time. But my fluency with who's making this stuff and whether there's something new happening is pretty low.
There's always really interesting stuff happening in podcasts because it's everybody and their mama can start a podcast in mm-hmm. some ways, not good quality, but they can. And so it's accessible. There's also lots going on, you know, people doing YouTube channel or Facebook videos. But to have, you know, non-traditional media being established itself, it's taking a little bit more time. It's part of it is because the market is so small, but it is happening for sure. It's also only a matter of time. Once again, like you have this generation who's not seeing itself being represented in French, and it's only a matter of time before it's something else. Either they're going to adapt or the system is not going to be able to sustain themselves. And even in terms of, and I hate to be speaking like that because it should be just a matter of trying to do the right thing. But even from a business standpoint, if you are looking like a smaller and smaller proportion of what the Montreal population is, your actual market is shrinking. So you need to adapt or your viewers or your readers are not going to get any younger.
I think adapt or die is the blunt phrase you were avoiding there.
Yeah, because it's a challenging environment for the media, even regardless of that situation, right?
What is it like to be you in this? Like, what are your mentions like, and what kind of response do you get for trying to navigate these complexities in your writing in a really raucous and engaged media ecosystem, media conversation,
right,
such as Quebec?
Right. When I write in French, I'm often told by trolls, not everybody, obviously, but by trolls, and there's a lot of trolls, that if I'm trying to address issues of either something about race or trying to, you know, rectify the dead angles around colonization, if I say that French Canadians were actually settlers and not colonized people, things like that, then I'm being told that it's because I don't know Quebec. Or that I don't understand their history. Obviously, the fact that they could be my cousins is erased. So there is that. And interestingly enough, because I used to live in Toronto, I'm being accused of being an Anglophone and being accused of being someone who's from Ontario, who's spying on Quebec. I don't know what. So there's also, I'm too close to you, Jesse. Oh.
Libelous.
Yes, yeah. I know. Like I spent too much time in Ontario, so I'm not actually a Quebecois anymore. I don't know if you knew, but yeah. And so there's that. And then on the other side, what I'm doing with you right now is actually, you know, trying to do a crash course of here's actually what Quebecois culture is. And here is the way that, you know, although there is racism like everywhere, here's how it plays out. And here's a summary of the other side of the debate. And so yeah, it's interesting how, like, I'm always accused of being a Quebec basher myself. And then because I'm playing, you know, I'm both in Quebec media and somewhat as well in Anglophone Canadian media, I'm being a kind of a diplomat on the other side. So yes, I guess I can be seen as one thing in the other. And it makes my life interesting if I see that both, I guess, you know, the Orange Lodge, Johnny McDonald fans attack me, and also like ethnic nationalist, xenophobic Quebecois also attack me. If I'm being attacked on both sides, I know that I'm where I'm supposed to stand. because both are wrong. It's always a sideshow that's going on, and if we need to focus really on the human rights issues in this country, we cannot let ourselves be derailed by this competition. It's never going to end.
If everybody's angry with you, you know you're doing your job.
Yeah, well, not angry, but if it's like I need to be trolled both in French and in English, then I know I'm doing my job right. Yeah.
No, we have some things in common, Emily Nicolas. It's been a pleasure chatting with you.
It's been a pleasure chatting with you too, Jesse.
That is your Canada Land. If you like this show, you can get it ad-free twice a week for $5 Canadian a month. Just go to canadalandshow.com/join or just click on the link in the show notes. You can email me at jesse@canadalandshow.com. I read them all. We are on Twitter at Canada Land. Our website is canadalandshow.com, and if you haven't yet, go there to sign up for our newsletter. You'll get everything that we have reported and published this week summarized for you, plus recommendations and picks and funny shit from our staff. Check it out. The senior producer of this episode is Rosalind Kufour. Additional production by Gabe Knox. Our managing editor is Andrea Schmidt. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. If you like this show, please support it.